Well, this is awkward.
You have the gospel reading and something's missing. What's missing from the gospel reading for the day? Were you listening? You're all thinking, I think I was. What's missing from the gospel reading? Rob? Yep. And there's something else missing. Jesus is missing. In the Gospel of Mark, which is the oldest gospel of them all, the first gospel written, the oldest text we have about the resurrection, the resurrection story, and the women turn up, the stone's rolled away, a young man's there, an angel, I assume, and says, he's not here, he's risen, and there's no Jesus. And the end of the story says, and they told no one anything because they were afraid. Awkward, isn't it? Really? Don't you reckon? So someone must have leaked. Here we are 2,000 years later and someone's told someone something. But it's fascinating to me that we often hear the resurrection story on Easter and we just go, oh, we know what happened. And our brains just take it in and go, oh, there was Jesus and there were other things going on. And in the Gospel of Mark, there is no Jesus at this point of the story. And I don't think Mark found that awkward, but everybody else did. So people then got to Mark's gospel and added some bits to the end. Because the last bits of Mark's gospel, from verse 9 on, aren't Mark's writing, they're somebody else. They fixed it for us. Disney got to it and made it all better. And Matthew and Luke and John tell entirely fuller stories, but Mark tells us this story, which ends with women running away in fear and telling no one anything. Why? Because they're afraid. They've just been told something that's entirely impossible, entirely improbable, and they've been told, go and tell somebody. Go and tell the disciples and Peter that Jesus has been raised from the dead. And they're thinking, oh, that's really going to happen. Because what's going to happen when the girls turn up and they say, we've been to the tomb, and tell the boys, because they're far more important, of course, aren't we? We're told that all the time. The boys are far more important. But tell the boys, Jesus has been raised. They're going to go, oh, fantastic, aren't they? They're going to go, yeah. What was it in the flowers? You see, this is the story of resurrection that we have that is first told to us in the gospel. This is the story of resurrection. It's the tale handed on from this angel young man at the tomb appearing in white robes, an empty tomb and chaos. Quite seriously, it's almost an April Fool's kind of story. When the women turn up and the wrong person's there and the right person is not. It's an abrupt ending which holds us in suspense, and Mark's community who first told and received this story are saying, but we know this is true because clearly at some point, and Matthew and Luke and John fill it out for us, the women told and the men didn't believe and checked. And if you read the stories all together, there's a whole lot of running going on. Women and men running around, surprise and fear, and Jesus popping up looking similar and different all the way through. It's chaos. Why? Because someone who was dead a couple of days ago isn't anymore and doesn't look quite the same. But just for the moment, let's stay with Mark's mess and avoid John and Luke and Matthew tidying it up for us, shall we? These women with whom the gospel is entrusted, from the moment of Jesus' conception to the cross and the resurrection, women are entrusted with the gospel story. The men are often on the wrong spot, or just simply don't get it. These women who are trusted with the gospel story are once again asked to proclaim to the world, first to the disciples and Peter, and then to the rest, that God has done the impossible. God has broken death. One of my favourite theologians says, without women preachers, we would have no knowledge of the resurrection. And that is entirely and absolutely true. Here is the gospel story. The ones that God shouldn't trust because they're the wrong gender are in fact proved by God once again to be entirely trustworthy. They were there at the end and that they were there at this new beginning. Here they are with the story in their hands and their hearts. So let me ask you a question for those who might want to guess. What do you think frightens them? What frightens the women? Is it the empty tomb?
They were afraid of being ridiculed.
They were afraid of being ridiculed. I think that's a good chance there. I think they were afraid of being ridiculed. They were afraid of what was going on. They were afraid of the story they were being asked to tell. They were afraid that no one will believe them. And in case you are wondering, well, I'm being a bit narky about the blokes, does Paul ever mention the women bearing witness to the story? Does Paul ever say a whisper or a breath about the women being first there? Does Peter, in his epistles 1 and 2, ever say a word in resurrection about the girls turning up first? So, maybe the girls were right. If we tell this story, somebody won't believe us. Probably the blokes. Because they're carrying a story which we celebrate and name as our highest moment in our faith and our history in creation and the world, and of course too the church. We take this moment, and the first ones to bear witness are frightened that if they tell this story, they won't get believed. They'll get ridiculed. That something might go wrong. And so here we are, a couple of thousand years later, and some change. And we're asked to bear witness to this story. We're asked to tell a story which in terms of faith or science or history or our experience is entirely impossible. To bear witness to a story which we can understand at the cross, we're appalled by it, but we can understand it at the cross, Jesus dying. But to think we're asked to bear witness to a story where God comes alive again in Jesus, and in a different kind of way, that's a challenge for each of us. Each of us is asked to bear that story. And I think we're entitled to feel just as frightened as the women did at the tomb. We're entitled to feel just as concerned, because if we try to tell this story to anybody, they're going to think it's a lifetime of April Fool's jokes rolled into one. But it's a story placed in our hands, entrusted to us. It's a story which we experience in prayer, in worship, in a moment of miracle and wonder. It's a story we experience that changes us and shifts us, which is why we're here. But in the same breath, we know that if we try to reason somebody into an argument about why Jesus was raised from the dead, someone's just going to go, yeah, not so much. There have been a couple of books written to try to prove Jesus was raised from the dead, and the arguments are quite coherent, except for one problem. Dead people don't come alive again. One small snag in the story. Everything else is quite reasonable. So at some point on this day, or on any day, we're asked to take a step that moves from Jesus, teacher, leader, healer, preacher, carer, justice bringer, advocate, proclaimer, sufferer, and crucified. And to move from that to a space that says, and we now say he's alive and alive forever. The angel says to the women, Jesus has gone ahead of you. And they're probably going, right. Right. To where? Jesus has gone ahead of you. And once again, here we are caught in this same story. What story? That Jesus is ahead of us, and we're trying to make sense still of the fact that somebody who is dead is now alive. And I have this great concern in the life of the church that we say it just like we're saying, we're losing at the cricket or at the rugby, or isn't the weather nice today? We just sort of say Jesus is raised from the dead like it's easy to believe or simple to accept. And it's just not. Even if you experience the God who shifts your heart and you say, oh, now I know it to be true, it's still a hard thing to say out loud when anybody asks you what it really means. Why? Because on this day, we say God has broken every rule we know. And the only rule that we know is that everybody dies. That's the only rule we know. Everybody dies. And God says in Jesus Christ, now I've changed that one. Now that one is no longer the story that we have to tell. So what does it mean to believe in resurrection? What does it mean? It means death isn't in charge anymore, yep. It means justice is different now. God has turned things upside down. The punishments and the rulers and the empires we thought we knew are no longer the ones in charge. At this time in history, the emperor was calling himself the Son of God. And so lo and behold, the church says, we've got a better one. We've got the real Son of God. So when someone stands up and says, Jesus is Lord, they aren't just proclaiming their faith, they're naming to the government and the powers that be, we have someone who is more valuable, more important, more alive. What's resurrection mean about suffering? Because we still suffer. People still have pain, nations still have wars, injustice still causes people to starve. What's it mean to believe in resurrection? We believe in it to say that suffering is not the final story. But yesterday in the Herald, Elizabeth Farrelly wrote an article about the resurrection being insurrection. I don't know if you saw it. The resurrection being insurrection. Because suddenly, the ones who thought they controlled everything, the Rio Tintos of the world, the Vladimir Putins of the world, the Donald Trumps of the world, are suddenly told, actually, you don't actually run the game at all. God runs the game. Death isn't in charge. God's love. And most of us go, yay. A few of us go, ah. And the ones in power say, I'm not too sure about that. How much of it is true, says Farrelly, in the sense of historical fact, doesn't matter. Matters not a jot, she says. Fact is the lowest form of truth. And she writes that just to stir us up, to get us narked about it, to get the Christians who are reading the article after the appalling editorial on Friday to get us really energised about it and start saying, but it's true. And she's not saying that it's not. She's saying, if you want to measure the facts out, how do you measure out the fact of resurrection? How do you measure that out? How on earth do you say to somebody, I can prove he was raised from the dead? All you can do is say, in my life, and in my faith, and in my hope, and in my sense of justice, or healing, or suffering, or need, I have met a God who says in Jesus Christ, I am forgiven, loved, healed, named, and known. And resurrection moves from being a story on the page, or a hope that we have, to a belief that actually changes us, to an experience of God that shifts us. I want to suggest to you that Mark deliberately only wrote 8 verses. I want to suggest to you that he wrote 8 verses and thought, ha, this will mix them up. And I want to suggest to you that we're the 9th verse, that we are verse 9. That Mark tells us a story which is impossible to believe and frightens the ones who bear witness to it. And then Mark says to us, so what are you going to do? Are you going to check this out or are you going to leave it lie? Are you going to pick this up or are you going to walk away? Mark says to us, you've got this story. What do you want to do with it? Do you want to poke it and check it out or do you want to say, I've got better things to do? We are the 9th verse of Mark's final chapter. God wants us to check it out, to embrace brokenness and to wrest life from it, to go to a tomb thinking everything is dead and discover that God has more yet to do and say in our world. This story only makes sense in us, It doesn't make sense on the page. It doesn't make sense simply as story. It makes sense when someone steps up and says to God, all right, if you're really God, show me. It only makes sense if we delve into the story and say, what does it mean for God not just to be crucified, but to be raised? It only makes sense when we embrace somebody and say to them, tell me how this stuff works. And the person doesn't then give us a Bible quote, but says, I didn't know what forgiveness was like until I met the risen Christ. That's what the story is. How does it make sense? It makes sense in us. And then Mark's story becomes complete. Then Matthew and Luke and John's stories make sense to us. And then we do more than simply worship and praise. We then want to be engaged with embracing the broken, speaking of justice, telling of hope, and bearing witness to this one who has broken the gates of sin and death, that all creation and all humanity might know the fullness of life itself. Will you pray with me? God of terror and joy, you arise to shake the earth. Open our graves and give us back our pasts, that all may be freed and forgiven, and that our lives may return to you through the risen Christ. Amen.